Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, this is a great time to give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And of course, along with your calls, some interesting topics to talk over.
Yes, napping in children. What's going on when your kid doesn't want to go to sleep and yet you want them to nap? Where's the scientific data for this and what can we do about it as parents? And then we're going to talk about grief, the grief reaction of parents who have lost a child in the first year of life. What does that mean to their morbidity and mortality and their health?
And we have a good recipe.
Fire, cracker, chicken, and it's just as you can imagine it. It is hot, it is spicy, it is delicious.
I'm waiting for that. And our medical mythbuster coming up later in the hour. Again, our number, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, to the phones we go. A listener with us now in Atlanta, Georgia. Hi.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for calling. How can we help?
Well, I had a, the beginning of last month, I had broken my arm in an on-the-job accident and fractured both the bones very, very well, one of them in multiple places. And I had two plates and 13 screws put in to kind of piece it all back together. I'm only 25, and I guess my question is, I've been reading different things online, and I don't know if I should have the plates taken out or when I should have them taken out. Things like that. Right now it's under workman's comp, but also I don't know if having it removed would also be covered under it or not.
Yeah, just what a bummer when that happens. You know, it reminds me, a few months ago I was hiking in the Redwoods in California and not doing very much at all, just came down some steepy stuff, and all of a sudden I slipped, foot went one way, rest of my leg went another way, and crack, and now I've got plates and screws, nuts and bolts in my ankle. And it's interesting. That's a good question, but I want to allay your fear. But first of all, how are you doing? How does it feel? Any pain or discomfort now, or are you doing pretty good?
It's not too bad. It's been about a month, and I was in a splint for a while, and I was in a cast, and a couple weeks ago I got out of the cast, and I've been starting physical therapy, and I got just about full range of motion back and everything.
Super.
And so now we're just starting to do some strength building exercises.
Excellent.
It was really close to my elbow where the break was, which was kind of odd. It's a little tender.
Yeah, it is tender. And a month really is not very, very much time at all. Actually, you never take out the screws. You never take out the plates. You never do anything like that unless it becomes painful. That's really the bottom line. In other words, there's no reason to remove them. No, they stay there. There's no reason. They do just fine. Now, you read on the net, people will say, oh, yeah, as soon as the bone is healed, you take out the screws. So basically, it's a surgical procedure. You know, you've got to get, you know, you have to have a block in order to pull out the screws. They'll take out the plate, and there's no reason to do it. Mm-hmm. And actually, when you unscrew a screw from the bone, you're actually cracking the bone. The bone itself is going to have some little micro cracks, and it's going to be painful. I wouldn't touch it at all. And frankly, there are a lot of people I see who have nuts and bolts and plates in their arms and legs and never have trouble. And then other people where the screw actually begins to turn, work its way out, and often, you know, it has to be removed. So it's a function of pain.
I heard that if I were, like, for heaven forbid, break this arm again and the plates were still in, like, it would be many times more traumatic. And serious possibility of actually losing that part of the arm because the plates and whatnot can cut through a lot more tendon and blood vessels and things like that.
Well, first of all, the chances that you will break that arm because you have regular bone that's going to heal completely and plates are much, much less than the chances that you would break the other arm. In other words, and basically, if you break that arm with the plate, it means you had more trauma to the arm, and that's why, and that's what's going on.
Okay.
In other words, because you have to break the metal, and you have to break the bone, so that means you need far more energy than a normal break. But no, it's a matter of simply doing your physical therapy and working on it, and you think about it, people have total hip replacements, right? They have total knees. Mm-hmm. They don't get them removed. They're metal. They're in their body for the rest of their lives. There's no reason to remove a plate.
He'll have to allow an extra 10 minutes at the airport, won't he?
He may have to allow an extra 10 minutes at the airport. Tom brings up a good point. You might set it off and you may not. Now, I have gone through the airport since I had my nuts and bolts in my ankle, and you know what? I don't set it off. But the first time you fly on an airplane, leave some time.
Sometimes they say, oh, it's not fair. You know, it won't set it off. You know, MRIs are fine, but other people say I get stopped every single time I go to the airport.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you'll find out what happens. Keep up with that physical therapy. Very important to get that range of motion back. The sooner you get it back, the better off you are. And don't break that arm again.
Mm-hmm. Don't plan on it.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yep, bye-bye. 800-462-7413. And to Carbondale, Illinois, we go now. Zorba, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, what's up?
Well, I have been having a problem for the past several years. It is every time that I drink, even if it's just two glasses of wine, two or three beers, the next four days, I'm so sick to my stomach that I can't hardly function. I don't feel hungover. You know, I don't have the headache, I'm not lethargic, I don't feel terrible. But, I mean, I'm so sick to my stomach, throwing up multiple times, terrible pain in my midsection. And it goes on, like I said, for at least 3 days.
Uh-huh. So you drink, when you go out and drink, how much do you drink?
Usually just a few, because...
What's a few?
Two or three.
Mm-hmm. No, I have to ask you that because I have people in my office and they'll say, I have a few drinks, and I'll say, what's a few? Say, I don't know, six pack or two.
Right.
You know, so few is a function of that. Doesn't bother you while you're actually drinking at all?
No, not at all.
Uh-huh. Burning feeling in the stomach?
Yes.
Kind of a burning. What have you taken for it?
I have tried every over-the-counter antacid.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I've tried, you know, your Pepto, your Maalox, all that, and it doesn't do anything.
Okay. Have you tried either Prilosec or one of those drugs, Prilosec?
Yes. Yeah, I've tried all those.
Uh-huh. How much you took just the amount of medication that's on the container or double the dose? Or?
I've tried both. Mm-hmm. Okay. Tried, you know, what it suggests, and then I've also doubled it.
Okay. You've seen somebody for this or not?
One time I did. It was so bad that I went to the hospital because it was just gone on for 4 days, and I couldn't get out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
But they just kind of gave me some pain medicine and thought maybe an ulcer, but they didn't scope me or anything.
Oh, sure. So you've never been scoped. Puts a damper on drinking. That's for sure, even a glass of wine. I have a couple of suggestions if you're going to go out drinking. I really do. What I would suggest is you go and get Prilosec, either Prilosec or Prevacid, P-R-E-V-A-C-I-D, Prevacid, which is also over-the-counter. Double the dose on the container. For Prilosec, that'll be 40 milligrams. For Prevacid, it'll be 30 milligrams. Take it on the day that you're going out. Say, hey, I'm going to go out, have a drink. Make sure you keep it on you. So you take it right away before you drink.
The same stuff you use for acid reflux.
For acid reflux. That evening, what you do is you take Zantac, 300 milligrams, double the dose that's on the bottle, 300 milligrams when you go to sleep at night. And the next day, take another Prilosec. What we want to do is try to stop the total acid in your stomach. That's what I think is going on. I think it sounds like acid. It smells like acid. We've got a saying in medicine, if you hear hoofbeats, don't think of zebras.
Yeah.
And so I think it's an acid thing. And sometimes a combination of Prilosec in the right dose, 40 milligrams, and Zantac in the right dose, 300 milligrams at bedtime can make a huge difference. And once again, another dose of Prilosec the next day, and you might be able to handle it. The next thing I would do is also look and see whether one drink does it or two drinks. Some people are very sensitive to alcohol, and if they take a drink, they're okay. But at two drinks, they're it's too much for their body.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I would do.
Okay.
You know, I think it's an acid issue. You know, it's funny. You know, we go out and we socially drink, and you know, sometimes we want to drink. I mean, I'm not a teetotaler. I like to have a glass of wine or glass of beer. I like the taste, and frankly, I like the relaxation that comes with a little bit of alcohol in my body. If I'm not driving, it's okay to even have more than a few drinks, and it just puts a damper on the social situation because in our society, we often drink when we go out or see people.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a big drinker, but I do. I enjoy the taste of wine, and we have a lot of beautiful wineries in southern Illinois, and I would hate to
Yeah, you want to enjoy that. It's an important part of life. So once again, Prilosec 40 milligrams, but when you're going out, Zantac 300 milligrams at bedtime, Prilosec the moment you get up in the morning. See how that works and let us know.
Okay, I'll definitely try it. Thank you so much. I appreciate
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Thanks
Thank
for
you for calling.
We don't tend to think of alcohol as being acidic, though, Zorba.
But alcohol causes, a lot of people can't tolerate it because it causes an increase in acid in the stomach.
Oh.
It's that it causes an increase in acid. So it's one of the things. Alcohol causes a lot of dyspepsia, you know, in the stomach. Just like coffee can do that for some people.
800-462-7413. You have some research, Zorba, on toddlers' naps.
Toddlers' naps. Toddlers' napping. Now, do you nap, Tom?
I used to, and I don't know.
Used to, because you used to get up much earlier.
Exactly
and that's
right.
It. Yeah. And I've been love naps. But kids, we often want to get our kids to nap because there's what a lot of researchers call sleep pressure. And it started about 100 years ago when a researcher said naps were important in order to keep kids going. And what the theory now is that sleep accumulates very quickly in a toddler's brain because basically there's a lot of stuff going on, synaptic activity, more synaptic activity in their brain that's going on, certainly in my brain or your brain at the time. And kids often need we know that children need much more sleep than
Just
adults.
Just to interrupt for a second, is that activity what allows kids to learn so fast?
Absolutely, because if you have, I remember I have four children, and when they were young, I can remember if I was gone for a day, the next day when I came home, I said, oh my goodness, look at how much they've learned in the day that is going on. There's tremendous neural activity that's going on, and that's the theory about why kids need that. And they build up something called sleep pressure. So it's hard to get them to sleep, but all of a sudden, bang, you know, once they sleep, it's a deep sleep, it's intense, and it happens suddenly. And they often are less able to tolerate long periods between sleep. And so what happens is, the theory is that we have pressure in our society for kids to do it, and they have to do it at a time. But by the time they're five, 80% of the kids have actually given up napping. So as a parent, you know that a baby has to nap. You know that a one-year-old has to nap. But often parents want a 3 to 5-year-old to nap. And often they don't have that same sleep activity. Their brains are not developing as quickly. And so parents really can't get their kids to sleep because there isn't that biological need to get them to do it. And I think that's part of the thing that parents have to realize. They're not necessarily going to get their kid to sleep for 20 or 30.
You can't push this thing. It happens and then it doesn't happen.
Exactly. And so you're working, you know, because many adults in our society do not nap, and this change in behavior happens somewhere around the age of 4 or 5. So I think parents simply knowing that a baby has to nap, we know, but that once they get to be a toddler, beyond a toddler, and they're about 4 or 5, they're not going to nap because the sleep pressure is not there. And therefore, the mom or dad in the house may not get all the stuff done that they want to.
We have an open line for you. Callers are waiting, but you can get in at 1-800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, to a listener in Livingston, Montana. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
I have had GERD, or acid reflux, for about 9 years. It showed up almost immediately after I had had a surgery. And I've tried all of the prescription medications that I'm aware of, Nexium, Prevacid, Prilosec, Acifex, Zegrid, and none of them help me. And I've made the lifestyle changes, you know, elevating my bed and giving up red wine and other things that I enjoy. But I still have all the symptoms of chest pain and belching, shortness of breath, choking on food, difficulty swallowing pills, and it's very annoying.
Yeah.
So I was looking at, I understand there's a surgery available, and I was wondering if you could tell me about it and the pros and cons, or if you have any other ideas of things I could try.
Let me ask you a couple questions before Zorba gets in on this. Are you sure you have acid reflux?
Well, that's what the doctors have told me.
I just asked because I've been diagnosed with acid reflux, and I don't have acid reflux. And the symptoms you mentioned are pretty much the symptoms I have. Do you know if the operation has to do with anything with your throat, widening the throat?
No, I thought it was something where they go in and tie off the top of your stomach so the acid can't back up.
Oh.
But I would be very curious if it is an acid reflux, what it could be.
Uh-huh. Acid reflux can be awful. And so there are two groups. You know, there are drugs there. The antacids, that's one group. There are things called H2 blockers. That's another group, such as Zantac. Then there are the PPIs, proton pump inhibitors, Prilosec, Nexium. Those are the drugs that are in that class. And they all work for some people. And what happens is some people take one or two or three, and some people don't get better. Tom, as you said, you needed something straightened out.
My problem was a swallowing problem. I didn't have enough moisture in my throat. It made it very difficult to swallow.
But you have burning in the bottom of your – you have burning in the pit of your stomach when you lay down? Is that what you have too?
I wouldn't describe it as burning when I lay down, but I know when I've gone in for my physical and they've – pressed on my stomach, it hurts.
Okay. And that's part of it. And you've been scoped.
Yes.
Okay, so the treatment is this. There is a trapdoor at the bottom of our esophagus, something called the sphincter. And the sphincter, when the sphincter doesn't close enough, the acid rushes into the esophagus and makes you feel bad. And we reduce acid, but the old-fashioned treatment that many people were given for esophageal reflux was this particular procedure that makes – it sort of ties the stomach around and not exactly in a knot. But as you can imagine, you've got a tube and it takes it and attaches it in such a way to the diaphragm and the ligaments, so it makes an artificial sphincter. That's what it does. And so acid no longer rushes into the esophagus. So what are the side effects? Well, first of all, there's surgery. Second of all, sometimes there's certain foods that will make people uncomfortable. I've heard people, when they drink carbonated beverages, do not like that when they have this particular surgery done. Some people get used to it. It's a different sensation in the stomach. Some do not. It is very effective. Some people then, when they swallow, have to eat slower because you've got, if you will, a tighter trapdoor into your stomach. So they have to eat a little bit slower, and they might have to chew their food a little bit more to get it down there. But let me tell you, I have maybe half a dozen patients in my practice over the last 5 or 10 years. The particular surgery is not done as often as it used to be at all, and all of them got better. All of them got better, and the acid, and they didn't mind the inconveniences of chewing food and cutting it smaller because they got rid of the acid reflux. So the surgery works.
Sounds great.
Yes, it is surgery.
I would try almost anything at this point.
Right, and that's exactly what people say. That's you. What you said hit it right. You hit it right on the dime. It's exactly what people say. They say, "I'll try anything at this point," and that's who the surgery is for. That's exactly who it's for. So my recommendation, though, when you look at a surgeon is find a surgeon who does more of them versus less of them. You don't want somebody who says, yes, I do these occasionally and I do 5 a year. That's not who you want. You want a surgeon who does many of them. So you want to interview people in your area and say, how many have you done last year? That's what you want to do. And that's – you ask your family doc or your internist who they would use, but I would interview more than one surgeon. And I do it on the phone. I would only use somebody who does lots of them.
Does a gastroenterologist do this?
Nope.
No, so it has to be
a surgeon. Right. And quite often they're thoracic surgeons because they're done in the chest. So they're actually thoracic surgeons who do other chest procedures, lung procedures, and do a lot of other procedures because it's done. It's often done. Sometimes it's done through the chest. Sometimes it's done through the stomach, through the abdomen. But in any case, whether it's done through the chest or it's done through the belly, either procedure, you want to make sure you're using somebody who does lots of them. And there are procedures that are less invasive and procedures that are more invasive. So do your interviews and at least visit two surgeons.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the call at 1-800-462-7413.
You know, when it comes to a surgery such as this, there are more invasive surgeries and less invasive surgeries because surgery marches on and has new technology. The real issue is you want to choose a surgeon who is very comfortable with the procedure, be it bioscope or not bioscope, and is doing enough of them, and that's going to give you a better result.
Mm-hmm. Now, before the break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox for a little fan feedback on a recent topic we were chatting about. Not too long ago, we were discussing the troubling trend of patients being discharged from the hospitals with fewer medications than when they checked in. Well, we heard from both sides of the issue on this one. A pharmacist from the hospital fills you in about an oversight. Dear Dr. Zorba, all patients in the hospital have a pharmacist available to provide med education to patients and family members. We catch a lot of those med errors and fix them. Please remember, we are the medical experts.
Right. No, and that is true. They do catch a lot of them. And this particular study showed a lot wasn't all. And that's really what it was about. But you're 100% right. The pharmacists do it. The issue, once again, is health literacy. You give information and people will look there and say, yes, they understand. Or they don't remember. And so there's an error rate, and reduction of that error rate by pharmacy and often by discharge nurses are really the major issue.
Well, now here comes Katie from Cody, Wyoming, who has an alternate thought. I am a hospital volunteer, hospice and cookie baking, who would relish the idea of being a patient advocate. All too often, those family members are as confused as the patient because they're likely sleep-deprived, intimidated, uneducated about the whole meds issue, and stressed out. I experienced it all when my dad was discharged after heart surgery. My mom couldn't really focus when the nurse was going over dad's aftercare and meds. Luckily, I walked in and started taking notes. There is plenty of room and need for advocacy, which everyone needs way more than they need sugar cookies. Now, could a volunteer help out with this problem?
Well, you need somebody who's trained to actually do it. A volunteer can do it, but they have to be trained. She brings up, you know, she's talking now from the patient point of view.
Yes.
And she has some interesting comments. Sleep deprived. May not really understand what is going on. They, you know, they're educated as to what this is, but what does that mean with education? Nobody ever tests. Okay, I told you about these five pills. Now read back to me about the five pills, and you'll discover, well, I understand three of the five, but not five of the five. She brings up a good point. It's all advocacy, and what you have to do is we have to educate our patients appropriately and make sure nothing falls between the cracks. But I love the comments that she made, and yes, you could train volunteers to do it. But how many volunteers do you need to do it in a big hospital?
And I would think that hospitals would have real legal concerns about a volunteer
corps. A number of issues.
Fulfilling this function.
You bet.
We love hearing from you, so keep it up. Just send your thoughts to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have such a yummy recipe coming up. Lots more of your calls. Our medical myth buster, too. All here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. A toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, we put together a recipe called Firecracker Chicken.
That's right. That's right. Do you like firecrackers?
Not so much on the 4th of July, but this seems to me to be hot food.
It is hot. It is hot. It is spicy. It is full body. Yeah. You will get compliments all the time when you put this on the grill. It is easy. And what's most important is you can prepare it in advance. It's great to actually eat cold. This is a wonderful, wonderful recipe.
Okay.
Something that even you could put together, Tom. You could do this. Now, do you grill at all, Tom?
Firecracker
chicken. Moving on. Tom, the non-griller, non-cooker, moving on. So, okay. So you start out, we're going to talk about the word rub, with 3 tablespoonfuls of paprika.
3 big T paprika.
Now, I recommend that you buy good paprika. Mm-hmm. You don't go out and buy, like, cheap paprika. Often we use paprika on top of deviled eggs to make them look kind of nice, you know, as a garnish. But paprika is widely used in along the Adriatic Sea, Macedonia, you know, all the provinces of old Yugoslavia. Paprika was really used pretty much in everything. Hungarian goulash uses paprika. I love to get Hungarian paprika. You buy it at the store in a tin. And remember, you want to buy it in a smaller container so it stays fresh, even though it's a dry spice. 3 tablespoonfuls of paprika. 1 tablespoon of freshly ground black pepper.
1 big T, freshly ground black pepper.
That's right. Do not use black pepper that is not freshly ground. It doesn't have the same fullness. It has the heat, of course, but it does not have the same fullness at all. 1 tablespoonful of kosher salt.
1 big T, kosher salt.
3/4 of a teaspoon of brown sugar.
3/4 of a little T, brown sugar.
3/4 of a teaspoon of chili powder. Now, when I mean chili powder, I mean the powder you buy in the store to make chili.
That's 3/4 of a little T.
Right. So it's not that, I mean, it has some bite to it, but it actually is a combination powder that has paprika in it. I think there are 5 ingredients in chili powder, but that's what you use. 3/4 of a teaspoon of garlic powder.
3/4 little T garlic powder.
1/2 teaspoon of ground cayenne pepper.
1/2 a little T ground cayenne pepper.
So there's the rub. You're smiling. As soon as you say pepper, you always light up, you know, because pepper is what you
I like hot food.
You love it. And you're going to use 3 to 4 pounds of chicken. Thighs or legs are really great with this. This is, I would really use a dark meat on this. You can do it with a breast. Just more taste. There's more fat in it. I mean, that's what it is. You know, you could do this with white meat, but it won't work as well. It's better. It's better with it. It's a dark meat recipe.
Okay.
I think. So combine the paprika, pepper, salt, brown sugar, chili powder, and garlic powder along with the cayenne pepper into a rub. And basically you rub some of it. You don't need a huge amount around the chicken. So the chicken has this rub all around it. Then you're coating it basically. Seal it in a nice freezer bag, one of those nice Ziploc bags. Place it in the refrigerator. And you can do this an hour before you're going to cook and even 8 hours before. So you can prepare it in the morning for a, you know, for the evening time. Prepare your grill to medium heat. Then remove the chicken from the refrigerator and coat each piece evenly with cooking spray on top of it. Grill it on the chicken for 30 minutes, turning occasionally until the juices run clear, or if you use an instant read thermometer like I do, until the thigh registers at 185. At that time, remove it, enjoy it, you'll love it.
Now I have a question. We have all this good hot stuff. And 3/4 of a little T brown sugar.
That's right. That's
Does that make any difference?
Absolutely.
Doesn't that get covered up?
No, it does not. It's amazing how sweet and salty just hit the tongue beautifully. It does not taste the same without brown sugar. You need the brown sugar in there. You really do.
And
you
this,
don't like? Do you like brown sugar?
Oh, I love brown sugar.
Yeah, it adds a little bit of taste to it. You don't taste for. You really don't even recognize the sweetness, but
it
does
change the taste to me.
Absolutely, no doubt about
it. This is good for us.
It's good for us. Absolutely. Well, it's, you know, once again, 47 calories from the, you know, from the chicken that you're using. If you're a white meat chicken person, then use chicken breast. I happen to like dark meat, and I think it tastes better. And this is delicious. And I bet you can get a copy from our website, don't you think?
I would guess.
If you go to ZorbaPastor.org, you can find this recipe, all of our favorite archived recipes, and you can sign up for our weekly podcast. And remember, we're also on Facebook. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, we have a caller from Berea, Kentucky. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me back, you all.
Oh, back. I recognize the voice?
I called a while back about some voice issues, and I was telling y'all that I was in a little band, Sugar Tree, and we're getting ready to go to Japan, and Zorba had suggested that I take some Prilosec to help my voice not be so squeaky.
Yeah, this is a while back, and you sang for us, as I recall.
I did.
What a wonderful treat that was.
It was. It was a very wonderful treat. So you took the Prilosec?
Yeah, so I took the Prilosec. I'm still taking the Prilosec, 2 20-milligram capsules in the morning on an empty stomach.
Excellent.
And it was around that time that I also transitioned to the 250/50 Advair with the advice of my allergist.
Uh-huh. And Advair, by the way, for people who don't know what it is basically a drug that we give people for asthma. It has two components to it. One is an anti-inflammatory component for the chest, and one keeps the spasm from happening. And so you're also on that medication for your asthma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I made that transition about the same time that I started taking the Prilosec. And so now I'm curious which is helping my voice out. I haven't had the squeaks.
Right.
And my band members are like, well, we're getting ready to go to Japan, so you absolutely can't stop doing either.
Yeah,
you
know? Right. Like, no, exactly.
Don't change anything.
That's exactly it. How long are you going to be in Japan for?
We're going to be there for 8 days.
Oh, how cool is that?
Yeah.
That's got to be wonderful.
Yeah.
How cool is
that?
Yeah.
We're so excited.
Yeah, it's very exciting. Well, first of all, number one is I wouldn't stop either one. I mean, your band members are right. They may not be in the medical profession, but they are absolutely correct. You don't want to change anything because it's working. And it may be A, one, the Prilosec, B, the increased Advair, or both. Probably the Prilosec plays a major role, and the reason is you were on the Advair before. You weren't at the higher dose, the Prilosec probably figures into this. There's nothing wrong with staying on the Prilosec. If you want to go off of it, what you want to do is pick a time that you can go off of it and see whether or not it makes a difference. And what I would do is I would go from the 40 milligrams a day to 20 milligrams a day. I'd stay on that for probably 2 to 4 weeks. And then if I felt exactly the same, I'd go from the 20 milligrams a day off of it completely and see. And the reason is that'll give you an idea of what role, if any, the acid reflux plays in what you have. But you want to do it at a time that the band isn't playing much because,
right.
You know, once the squeaks come back, how long did it take for you to get rid of the squeaks this time?
It took a few weeks.
Right.
It took a few weeks, but
right.
By the end of the month, I was at a practice, and they both looked at me and they said, you know, your voice is really, it's really in a better place these days. And I said, I think you're right.
How cool is that? Well, you know, so there's nothing wrong with taking 40 milligrams of Prilosec. I have people who have been on that every day for years. So you don't have to even get off of it if you don't want to. And once again, you know how it took a bit of time to get back. Be careful, because when you stop it, your voice may go back to become squeaky, which you can't have. So
are you going to be releasing a Live from Tokyo album?
Well, we have a little album that we put together and produced ourselves, and we're hoping to do a studio album when we get back. So.
Well, congratulations. I'm so glad that we were able to help you, and good luck on your tour.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it, and I know that the other folks in the band appreciate not having to change keys and stuff on the fly to accommodate this week.
Thanks a lot for the
call.
Thank
you. Thank you so
much. Thank you all. Have a great day.
Thanks.
Before we get to the break, Zorba, let's check in on the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and take this quick note from Bill in Jacksonville, Florida. Bill's stumbled onto an alternate recipe from one of ours. I'll let him finish the story. He writes, Dr. Pastor and Tom, I heard your recipe for tangy Italian potato salad. It has quickly become a family favorite. I recently brought a big batch to work for a potluck lunch. I had some left over, so the next morning I experimented and fried some up for breakfast.
Ooh.
They were amazing. I used a nonstick skillet, so no need for butter or oil. I added just a little salt and a healthy dose of black pepper, and now I have two favorite ways to prepare potatoes. Thanks for the healthy and tasty recipes.
I love it. I'm going to have to try it. That sounds absolutely delicious. Thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Well, don't be shy about sending in your recipe experiments. You can post them on our Facebook page or just send them to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some interesting research coming up, some more of your calls, of course, and, of course, our medical myth buster, too, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, some interesting research on a very serious topic.
Yes, yes. This is an article that came out in one of the British medical journals, very important, about a parent's bereavement and grieving for a child that they've lost. Mm-hmm. And this is they were looking at parents who lost a child in the first year of life. So they may have lost it, you know, a week into the, you know, child's life, or a month, or 2 months, or 9 months, but up to a year. And they looked at a sample. They looked at death registrations in Scotland, and then they went back and looked at the parents of the child that had died. And they found some fascinating things. And this was a study. They looked back from 1970, 1971, all the way through to 2006. So they had a very, very broad sample. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that a mother or a father of a child that had died within the first year of life, that mom or dad, were roughly twice as likely to die in the 15 years following the child's death.
In the 15 years.
Right, right. What they're beginning to call broken heart syndrome, which is definitely there. And the mothers were more likely to die than the fathers. In other words, the mothers appear to be up to 3 to 4 times more likely to die of certain deaths within that first 15 years. And gradually over time, that increased death rate seemed to disappear. But it took roughly 2 decades before they approached the normal level.
Wow, so there really is such a thing as a broken heart.
Right. Now, the questions are, what did they die from? Well, they look back once again and looked at the data. They couldn't rule out that suicide was more likely, but that's clearly as a broken heart. But it may be alcoholism that developed. It may be activities that are much more dangerous. A dampening of the immune system is one theory, that people who are not nearly as robust, sort of maladaptive behavior, unintentional injuries because they're thinking of the child, a whole bunch of things.
Yeah.
But we need to have more research into this because we have to intervene. I mean, childhood death is less and less common, but it's not totally rare.
How would we possibly intervene? This is such a personal tragedy. What could society or anybody
else
do?
Well, if you recognize that that this grief is going to last for this very long period of time, and we'll say part of health maintenance of going into the doctor's office is putting, you know, trying to look at things that may develop, sort of preventive care, and say, look, you lost a child, it's 5 years out. How are you doing? Maybe giving a depression questionnaire, maybe sampling them, are you still grieving, getting them counseling. There are a lot of things that you can do and intervene if you realize that broken heart syndrome is there. And it's very clear that parents who lose a child, a very young child in that first year of life, can carry that scar with them for years and years to come.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next listener is in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi. It's so great to be on your show.
Oh,
good to
thank
have
you.
How can we help?
Well, I take Lyrica for some nerve pain in my, especially in my legs and feet. I have some form of myelitis, And actually, it's a great drug, and I'm active and do things, but I've noticed a weight gain. And a friend from Pfizer said, oh, have you had that side effect? And so I'm wondering, well, first of all, what causes the weight gain? And then how do you get rid of it? I mean, why did drugs give you a weight gain?
Just as a curiosity, how much weight are we talking about?
Well, not a lot, but I have some jeans and stuff that, and skirts that don't fit me anymore, which is discouraging. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been probably 5 to 7 pounds that I've gained. Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's exactly that particular drug I'm very, very familiar with. That's exactly what that drug does. It increases it somewhere between 5 pounds, 8 pounds. How does it do it? Well, the drug actually doesn't do it. It's that people who are on the drug gain weight, and they do it by eating more calories or exercising less. I mean, the drug doesn't produce it, produce the weight. Why does it do it? We don't know. We don't know why some drugs tend to do that, whether it's just that people feel better and have less pain and they eat more, or, you know, it changes the appetite, or it changes the way the food is metabolized. I don't think anyone really has a good handle on it. But it is a known side effect from it. Now, Lyrica is a drug given often for chronic pain, fibromyalgia, diabetic neuropathy, painful legs, post-shingles pain. Why are you taking it?
Well, I started in 2004, and actually it was kind of a new drug treatment.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
At that point, and I remember my neurologist kind of fingering the box. It was actually in Switzerland where I started taking it, and I just moved back to the States. But I had an undiagnosed neuropathy, and then at WashU, it was diagnosed as a type of myelitis. So that's all I know in my lower spine.
Right. Does the drug work? Is it work for you?
Oh, it's fabulous.
Yeah.
It's a great drug, and it has very few side effects, so I guess I shouldn't be complaining.
No, no. Everyone in America complains about weight gain. I've never been anyone who hasn't complained if they gained weight. Gee, I gained weight. I'm so happy.
When you're really, really skinny, you're pretty happy to gain a little bit of weight.
Actually, Tom is correct. About 5% of the population is thin or skinny, and they really do want to gain weight. But people, you generally, if they're on a drug and they say, you know, I gained the weight, they're usually displeased. I think I would stay on the drug. I'd look at your calories, increase your exercise, and try to sort of attend to that fact. But you've been on it for 7 years. It works well. You're not going to stop the drug. And frankly, the other drugs in this class, such as gabapentin, which was called Neurontin, can also, I'm sure, cause a weight gain. So
I do exercise. I do water aerobics pretty aggressively twice a week.
Yeah.
So
you know, the other option is just, you know, you got to go to Penny's and get those new jeans.
Well, I wanted to do a very bad grammar mistake so that Tom might do a message on my answering machine and beat you out by saying you're my most favorite show.
Ain't that the truth?
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
At 800-462-7413. And Zorba, time once again now for our medical myth buster. Today's myth deals with one of your more popular recipe recommendations, sea salt, a.k.a. kosher salt. While you recommend it often, is it actually a lower sodium substitute for table salt?
Well, a few things. First of all, kosher salt is not always sea salt. So the kosher salt is just chunkier and maybe mined in the ground. Sea salt is made by basically taking salt water in the sea, evaporating the water, and then the salt is there. And the theory that some people have, because it has micronutrients, is that it's better for you.
Well, can kosher salt be sea salt?
No. Well, yes, kosher salt could be sea salt.
But all sea salt. Salt isn't kosher.
That's
salt.
Well, and sometimes, but sea salt, which is sort of the buzz hot salt where people are paying more and more money for, and they say it has less sodium, and it doesn't have less sodium. It has the same sodium pretty much ounce for ounce as kosher salt, sea salt, and regular salt. If you take a measurement of 1 ounce of each, it has roughly the same sodium content. The micronutrients are slightly different, and there's some chefs who believe that sea salt tastes a little bit different because it has other minerals minerals in it because it has magnesium and calcium in very, very trace amounts. But sea salt is not lower in sodium than regular salt or kosher salt. Well, and so people begin to believe, I can use sea salt with impunity. And the answer is no, it's salt.
But now sometimes we'll have a recipe and you'll say sea salt.
Absolutely. And that's a taste issue. Mm-hmm. That's a taste issue. It's not a sodium issue. And it's a myth that sea salt has less sodium than regular salt. And that's the myth we want to bust.
Well, let us season up your myth before we bust it. Just send your medical myths to the show in an email to
Zorba at WPR.org.
Again, 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And Zorba, we have a listener with us now in Lafayette, Indiana. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
I have a problem. I wore a ponytail for a while. I'm African American, and the ponytail took some of the hair out at the crown of my head, and I wanted to know, is there anything that I could do to get it to grow back or anything? I went to a dermatologist, and they took a sample, but they, you know, couldn't give me a yay or nay or what. What would you be your suggestion?
Oh, sure. Tell me, how long is it? You wore a ponytail for many, many years?
No, I only wore it for like a month. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, my scalp started itching, so I had the beautician take it back out. And then when she took it out, you know, my hair was, you know, like gone. It came out. You know,
right.
From the
right.
Crown of my head.
Right. When did that happen?
It's happened about 2 years ago.
So about 2 years. Has any of it grown back, or has it stayed pretty much the same?
There's like little sprays of hair there.
Oh, okay.
But not all of
okay.
it.
You know, you bring this up. It's quite interesting. I recently read an article about African American women who are braiding hair and ponytails and all other things, and the stress that it puts on the hair follicle, and how this is producing lots of hair loss. Mm. In African American women, you are not alone. This turns out to be much more common than was heretofore thought, and that's because of the stress on the hair follicle. And there's no perfect treatment for this, unfortunately. Usually, the hair will grow back. Sometimes they'll inject steroid into the scalp right under where the hair loss occurs. Have they tried that at all, the dermatologist?
No, what he did, he said that the scalp was irritated, so he gave me this prescription for the shampoo.
Okay.
And he said it was inflamed, so I had started using that. He said he wanted to treat that, and he just basically was more like an antibiotic, but never said anything about the hair growing back. So,
well, I would look towards the possibility of steroids and whether or not a steroid injection into the scalp may actually cause the hair follicles to then begin to grow again. That's where I would definitely try that, because sometimes people have something called alopecia areata, where there's a blank space in their hair, and if they put a steroid in, the steroids can actually cause it to grow back. I think I would try that with this. It's a problem. Obviously, you're not going to pull on your hair with a ponytail again.
No. I've been wearing a wig because, you know, it's like no hair there.
Yeah.
So I've been basically covering up. And of course you see all the commercials about, you know, getting the hair, you know, for men and women mm-hmm. with hair loss. So
right. Well, the other possibility would be to try Rogaine.
Okay.
Over-the-counter Rogaine. Rogaine does work for women just like it does work for men. You can't use Propecia, which is what's used for men, because that has to do with testosterone. But Rogaine, and you can go to the store and get Rogaine for women, generic. It's the same as Rogaine for men. And you might want to try that and see if that also helps.
Okay. So. Is there any side effects or anything? Do you know?
You've got to be careful how you use it. If you follow the package insert, generally there are no side effects. It's a topical treatment, and that often can work quite well. So,
okay.
Good luck to you.
Thank Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for the call. Maybe you and I should try some of that.
Yeah, but mine didn't come from a ponytail. Not at all. Not at all.
Before we clock out for the week, Zorba, let's take care of a little Zorba Pastor on Your Health grammar police business. Not too long ago, we put a call out to all of our grammar-friendly fans to inform us about the amount you're talking about when you say the word several.
Oh, right. That's right. We have discussed several, few, couple I know is two. But
yeah. Well, several members of the Zorba Pastor on Your Health grammar police notified us, and here is what they said. Deputy Mary from Shanahan, Illinois, remembers it this way. One is one, a couple is two, a few is three, and several means seven or more.
Seems to me there's a gap in there somewhere. It also sounds like something that the deputy probably said in kindergarten. It sounds like a rhyme or a song.
Oh, yeah. Well, Deputy Alex from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, was a bit more precise, writing, I just wanted to clarify on the definition of the word several. According to Merriam-Webster Dictionary, several is an indefinite number, more than two, and fewer than many. So it is entirely acceptable to refer to three as several. But words lying between several and many.
That's right.
Is that nine or 107?
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. You know, our deputies, I don't know about the ones with the real badges, but the ones with the real badges are often pretty definite about things. So, yes. Yes, deputies, I think the answer is there's a difference. Yes, several and many. When do we go from several and many?
Well,
the deputies know. Believe me, I get calls from the deputies at home every day. No, I really don't. Telling me about my grammar.
Well, many thanks to our grammar police force for their help on this issue. If you want to join the Zorba Pastor on Your Health grammar police, you can do so by sending an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. And one email is enough. You don't have to send many.
See you in many days, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org and find us on Facebook.
Don't forget you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Executive producer Adam Friedrich and technical director Brad Kohlberg, the Larry David and Jeff Green of the radio production team are the two enthusiasts responsible for this hour. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1001Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.